So I've been 20 years in Paradox class, and one of the first people in class that befriended me was Mark Perez. And on and off for 20 years, Mark and I get together for lunch after class or during the week, and I feel like when I'm done with one of my lunches or dinners or a beer with Mark, like I'm the luckiest guy in the world. Mark has been a true and good friend to me, and I to him, I hope, over the years. And he's got all kinds of qualifications and all of that, but I want to introduce him as my friend. And a few months ago we had the idea, because we both get excited about these conversations that we have, why don't we take one of our conversations on the road, as it is, and do it in front of class? A road show. So if this falls completely flat, you know, you can tell your grandkids that you were there when Mark and Ross made complete knuckleheads out of themselves. But we think it's going to go well. We have a way of being able to talk to each other that I think is almost like a third person in the room. And often we disagree with each other, but it's always respectful. And we just thought it would be fun to try to share it. And the way we did this morning was we picked a topic and didn't really talk to each other about it. We just figure we'll wing it. And I have a 3-slide PowerPoint to just kind of do a bare bones guide on this. And really what we're going to talk about is two things. Hugh Ross talks a lot about evidences for the God of the Bible, the theistic God. We want to offer what we think is a really easy way for anybody to argue for the God of the Bible. And then the second part of that, which is part of the evidence, this idea of naturalism, that there is nothing supernatural, is under more attack. That idea that naturalism is true is under more attack even by many naturalist scientists than ever before. So I think that the evidence for the God of the Bible is stronger from a scientific, historical, philosophical standpoint than it's ever been. So Mark and I are going to talk about it. So welcome, Mark.
Thank you.
Yeah. So there's no coffee or beer or anything here.
I got mine. I was going to get you some, but you were going to have some.
I was going to get you food, but I didn't want to share it.
Okay.
With you.
That's good.
I figured you can get your own.
Yeah, last time I shared a fork with you, I got sick.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, it's because you're just not a tough guy like him. So, here, let's go to this first slide, Mark. Here's what I want to talk, I want to say, how do we argue for anything that we argue about in life, whether it's politics or faith? What is the best explanation for the data that we have? And there's a philosophical term for that kind of argument, right?
Yeah, sometimes it's called abductive reasoning. And abductive reasoning just is explaining data or getting the best explanation from the data from at least 2 or 3 or more theories mm-hmm. or ways of looking at it. So if you want to call it abductive reasoning, you can use a nice fancy term like that, or arguing from the best explanation or to the best explanation.
Okay.
Is the same thing.
Isn't that the kind of reasoning that people use in everyday life more than any other kind?
Most of the time, unless they're doing something really silly.
Yeah. So if your kid comes up to you and the cookie's missing out of the cookie jar and there's a chair in front of the counter and a trail of cookie crumbs to his room and he says the aliens came and took the cookies, this is the kind of reasoning we use to analyze that kind of statement, isn't it? We just look at it and we say, what's the most likely answer?
That's the bottom line, is what is the most reasonable response given the data?
Right.
And you can get into a lot of interesting questions about what counts as data. Because You have problems or questions of relevance. You know, what's relevant
right.
to this question? How does it weigh against the other data? And what are data to begin with? I mean, are data just numbers? Are they other kinds of information? And so we can use the term data, but we need to really be careful what we mean by that. So, you know, I know it's you and me talking, but there's other people listening. And so I would say if we're going to talk about data, we're going to be, in this respect, we'll use a looser term, meaning whatever is presented to our senses.
And we have to figure out what data is relevant, right?
Yeah.
Because some data doesn't have any bearing on the situation.
Yes, and that's what's important about that is that what makes it relevant, if we were going to, say, recur to a legal definition of relevance, what makes it relevant is that it has a tendency and reason to prove or disprove a fact. So if a fact at issue, not just any fact. So if it's relevant, that means that there's some reason why we should be looking at this to prove some fact in a chain of an argument mm-hmm. that leads to a conclusion. So some people can say, well, that's not relevant because they don't like it. That doesn't qualify as irrelevant.
That's right.
It's irrelevant when it has no tendency and reason to prove a fact at issue.
So what data is included is up for debate, is a matter of opinion. You may say it's a relevant piece of data, and I may say no, and it's not a hard and fast thing, right?
That's right. And it's really important in science, because what theoretical approach you're taking will often determine what counts as data.
Right.
And that's really important to for people to understand that, is that, you know, Thomas Kuhn, the great philosopher of science and historian of science, wrote a book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions back in 1963.
You gave me that book and I read it.
Yeah.
It was great.
It was fantastic.
Ago.
Yeah. That was part of my schooling, and we couldn't get away from that book. What Thomas Kuhn did was he said, look, I'm going to call something a paradigm. And then he used it differently at different times. But a paradigm for Kuhn was this large model, a structure in which the particular scientific discipline recurs to it to determine what counts as evidence, mm-hmm. what counts as a fruitful research program, what counts as a conclusion, a justifiable conclusion, and what counts as real progress. And so when we're looking at data and we're thinking about relevance, the paradigm that you're in determines what will count, even as what are effective questions. So we'll get into that when we start talking about things like naturalism and supernaturalism, because those are two different, entirely different paradigms.
Right.
And so the naturalist sees things one way and will reject a priori, up front, even the possibility that this question might be asked.
Well, let me give an example, and it's jumping ahead a little bit, but I think I've got here, I just got these on Friday. It's a two-volume set of 1,200 pages on miracles, written by Craig Keener, who's a conservative New Testament scholar and a real scholarly guy, and he's got hundreds and hundreds of pages of modern-day, present-day documented miracles from a Christian standpoint. Now, in keeping with what you're saying, Richard Dawkins would probably not even read this.
Richard Dawkins would say that's irrelevant because it doesn't tend to prove anything, and that the questions it's posing aren't even reliable questions.
So we would include it as evidence for the supernatural. He wouldn't even allow the inclusion of it as evidence one way or another.
He wouldn't, because he rejects supernaturalism up front.
A priori.
Yeah.
Right. By the way, we are going to take questions, so I think give us about 10 minutes to kind of get our basic thoughts together, and then if you guys want to take questions, let's do it. Let's make it a conversation with the whole class. I think that would be really fun. One other thing, Mark, that I think is really important as we're arguing for this is to look at what direction the data is headed in. In other words, the origin of life is one we're going to get into. There's really been very little progress made in that field in 60 years, and indeed what's happening is that we're finding more and more and more and more problems with naturalism, because we just, like an artichoke, we peel back these layers, and there's more and more complexity that can't be explained.
Well, there's more than just complexity. There are problems. There are anomalies. There are these predictions that the theory makes, and then when they test it, the predictions fail. And when that occurs over and over and over, and they get results that are not only not a yes to their hypothesis, but a yes to something else that does not fit in their paradigm, then they start to end up pushing themselves into a crisis. And I think they're there now. They will never admit that, but the origins problem is their most intractable problem, because when we get talking more about evidence, they're stuck with running into, they're stuck with having to come up with a wishful thinking argument rather than a scientific argument to believe in a naturalistic origin.
Yes. How important in... It's an echo. How important in, your degree is in philosophy of science, how important is this issue in analyzing an argument, the idea of what direction is the data headed in?
Exactly what do you mean by that?
Is the evidence moving in historically in one direction? For example, Hugh Ross keeps adding more and more features of the universe, galaxy, solar system, planet that have to be fine-tuned for life to exist in any form. The direction is towards more features.
Yeah, I wouldn't use the term direction.
Okay.
And what I would say is, what is the state of the evidence?
Okay.
And the reason I distinguish those two is, if you say direction, you're predicting a particular outcome, and you don't have the authority to do that. And what I mean by authority is not that you have some kind of judicial authority,
right,
or political authority, but you haven't got the substance of the argument that you're going to make already proved. So with that, you have this inconclusive prediction. You're still accumulating evidence. There are other predictions being made or other explanations that are being posed. It's difficult to say that any of this is progressing in any particular direction. It's more appropriate to say, here is the state of evidence with this hypothesis or that hypothesis, and let's compare those different states of evidence.
Right. Which kind of gets to my point, and these are the two points that I really want to pound home with the audience. If somebody says they don't believe in God, what you want to say is, what does the evidence give us right now? And we know, most of us in this class, what a lot of that evidence is. If they say I'll wait till that's another point. But people don't get to say, well, as evidence comes in, it's going to, naturalism will be redeemed. God will not exist. You gotta beat them on the head. You gotta say, what does the data say right now? The data as it is, right now. You don't get to predict where it's going, which is my mistake. You're right. What direction is the data headed in? I'm making the same mistake that I'm refuting in the next sentence.
Well, one of the things we have to think about also is, if we're going to ask the question, you know, what is the state of the evidence, and the naturalist is saying, well, if we just keep on doing what we're doing, we're going to find the answer. I would answer the naturalist, and I say, well, what warrants that claim?
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between your claim being a prediction and your claim being merely wishful thinking? That's an extremely important point, because if we're going to be talking to scientists or people who are skeptical, we're going to hear the argument, well, science over the centuries, particularly the last century, has made fantastic progress. And so we have good reason to believe that it's going to continue this way. And we will answer these intractable problems because we've done it before.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you answer that?
My personal answer is that the stickiest points for a naturalist happen to be the very same points that the Bible makes it clear, are very explicit, that God did it. Origin of the universe, origin of life, origin of humanity, origin of consciousness, and probably, you know, speciation on some level.
Sure.
Genesis is really clear that God took a hand in all of those features. And not coincidentally, in my opinion, those are the very same features that naturalism has the most problem explaining.
Well, we have to be careful when we use terms like speciation, because that's not really well defined.
Right.
But certainly the separations of kinds at the very top level.
That's right.
Know, like phyla and those high taxa. So that would be correct if we're going to make sure we're precise in our language. And we have to be, because the people we're talking to, some of them will be lay people, but some of them will be experts. And they'll chew you up and spit you out really quickly if we're not precise about our language.
And we have to admit, as believers, we may not be guilty of it as individuals, but the church has, over the centuries, made claims about what God has done miraculously, some process, and then had to retract that as science progressed and was able to explain it.
Yeah. Yeah, there has been a God of the gaps.
Yeah.
I would call it misplacement. They placed God in gaps that didn't have to be there.
Can you, you brought that up, Mark. Let's talk about what is the difference between abductive logic, reasoning to the best explanation, and the either God of the gaps or naturalism of the gaps argument, because they're as guilty of it as we are. Can
sure.
you talk about the difference between those two kinds of arguments?
Well, anytime you have a gap in knowledge, or you're trying to explain something using a theory, and you don't have any way to explain it, and you apply your theory, you're saying, if my theory is true, then this gap will be explained by these kinds of experiments.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have things like the origin of life. That's a huge problem. It's a huge problem for theism. It's a huge problem for naturalism. And the reason it is that neither one of us has access to the original information.
Right.
So we don't have any data other than some very remote, attenuated data. So if we're going to look at something like that, that is so difficult a problem that we just don't even have access to the fundamental information it takes to answer the question, then either one of them could be a God of the gaps or a naturalism of the gaps. Now let's move a little bit different way here. Now let's look at problems that are less of an issue, like the origin of man. So we do have access to DNA, we have access to some fossils, we have access to some other things. There, either side can make their claims, but they have a little bit more evidence for it.
Mm-hmm.
And they can work from that evidence. So if you're going to go back to the origins and you're just going to say, well, what do we have at the moment? We'd have to say, well, neither one of us has a whole lot of anything. Until we step back and start magnifying our theories and saying, what are the limitations of the theory? And what I mean by that is science necessarily blocks itself into natural causes for natural effects.
Right.
Theism does not. Theism admits that there are things like God.
Right.
Who can create, can cause things that have natural effects.
And let me just break in there quick, because that's one point I really want to make. They accuse us of having, naturalists accuse theists of having the bias, that we look at it in terms of everything, in terms of God did it. But I think that they're the ones with the bias. We're looking at the data. We're willing, hopefully, willing to look at the data and say, what's the best explanation? Maybe there's a theistic explanation. Maybe there's a natural explanation. That's more of an unbiased position than, as scientists, we will not allow any supernatural explanation.
It certainly is less biased, because the scientist who believes in scientism, you know, the ideology that science explains everything that needs to be explained, they're boxed in by that because they have no proof that what they're saying is true. Because by definition, they can't go outside of that. So if there is a God, they would never be able to detect him.
Right.
Because they refuse that a priori. So in that respect, they're in a hurt box, and that bias makes it impossible for them to look at other positions, like a theistic position. Although you'll get some of them that'll say, well, you know, origin of life, we can't quite figure it out here, but maybe aliens put seeded life here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a problem too.
That's weak.
Well, that's really weak. I think it's stupid, actually, because the reason I say it's stupid, and I don't mean to insult anybody, but the reason it's stupid is that if you're going, think about what you're saying. If you're an atheist and you hold that position, what you're saying is some being with enough power to bring life to Earth that you've never seen, you've never talked to, and you don't understand.
And for which there is no evidence.
For which there's no evidence and no explanation, brought life here, and yet God does exactly the same thing and has exactly the same standard or standing in your paradigm, Mr. Naturalist. How is it that you reject God and accept the aliens, right, who are the same epistemological weakness?
Plus, it just begs the question, who designed this alien life?
Exactly.
Because it's assumingly as complex as us and would have evolved like us in their paradigm, and it would have had to have happened for them with even less time, because it would have taken them a long time to get smart and get here.
Yes. Well, you have two issues there. The first one is, even if you accept that the aliens exist, for which you have zero evidence, your belief in the alien has no more warrant than a belief in God.
Right.
I can't see the alien. I can't see God. I wasn't there to see God create. I wasn't there to see the aliens plant. We have no way of knowing what the aliens are like. If I were a naturalist, I'd say we have no way of knowing what God is like. The only difference is what you just hinted at is the theist has more data.
Right.
Whereas this person who holds the scientistic ideology bars that other data.
That's right.
And so now they're really in a hurt locker with that alien explanation, because it doesn't make any sense. It is literally stupid. You have to go to sleep to believe it.
So if somebody says to you, Mark, I just don't believe in the supernatural, and that's been a paradigm that I've had in my life, and it's served me well, and I'm this super-duper scientist, and I've made a whole career on believing that, how would you respond to that? What would shake that faith?
Well, the question I would ask first is, what's your evidence?
Excellent.
Yeah. What evidence do you have that there is no supernatural?
Yeah.
And the next question would be,
for which there really isn't a good answer.
I don't think there is.
There is not an answer to that.
No, that's a problem, although some of their answers are pretty clever. But the second question I would follow up with is, okay, give me your evidence. I don't think they're going to have any, but let's say they come up with some. The question next would be, what evidence would it take for you to relinquish your belief?
In other words, is it falsifiable?
Yeah. If it's not, then hey, you can believe in the, you know, the fairy godmother spaghetti monster.
The flying,
you know,
spaghetti monster,
yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so once they say that, then they've got to hang themselves on two things. What's their evidence, and what would it take to change their mind?
Right.
And if they say, well, I don't really have any evidence, and nothing would change my mind, then you've just entered a conspiracy theory, because there's no way to prove or disprove it.
You know, and that's really interesting, because at core, Christianity is an evidential faith.
It's extremely important for the evangelist.
Yes, because Paul says, if Jesus Christ wasn't resurrected from the dead, and not in some kind of weird, mystical, sort of symbolic way, but physically, you know, this body that's been dead and has started to decompose, came back to life, if that fact didn't happen at a point in human history, your faith and everything you believe is in vain. It's like, that's my story and I'm sticking to it, you know?
Yeah, Christianity has this interesting nature of being two things at once. And they're fused and they're also separate. One of them is that it is a spiritual enterprise, okay? Because
right.
God is spirit, we have spirits in us. But it's also empirical in that God did not expect us to accept his existence without looking at the world. So we make observations, we hear things, we sense things with our senses. And so he is holding us accountable, especially if you go to Romans 1. I mean, we are held accountable to know his existence, his eternal power, and his nature by looking at creation.
Right.
So the very foundation of Christian theism is empirical. God says, look, pay attention. There's no way to make it merely this spiritual, vague, abstract thing. This is flesh and blood and observations. And so our faith is a spiritual faith, but yes, our faith is also empirical.
And when Jesus came and he had all these amazing words of life, and yet why did many people believe in him? Because of the amazing things that we would call miracles now, the things that he did that established his authority. He didn't expect people just to believe his words about love and him and his identity without, you know, here's the beef. This is, you know, let me heal some people and bring them up from the dead and make a great party at the wedding that had no wine. The wine was all run out. You know, people
sure.
believed, and he knew that. He said, this is why I've done this, to establish who I am.
Yes. It's all about, well, he did both things at once. So he was repudiating the Pharisees. He was repudiating their man-made rules. And so he was talking a spiritual argument to them and to the others, because it was moral and ethical problems and religious problems. But then he was violating what we all know to be the laws of physics explicitly,
right,
to make sure we knew what those laws of physics were, and to justify exactly what you said, is to authorize or authenticate his place as God, and that the spiritual realm is here and it's visible.
Right.
And invisible at the same time.
And you know, what does he say? That one of the evidences that he is real is, it is a supernatural transformation, but it is a real transformation that each of us knows in our own gut is happening inside of us, that cannot be explained by, well, I'm just trying harder, you know.
Yeah. It doesn't work.
No,
yeah.
It doesn't work. I've tried it.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. Well, any questions? You guys want to say anything? Norm, or wait for the mic.
Yeah, I want to go back to the your comment you made. What if you're confronted with the statement that I don't believe in the supernatural? Well, okay, science, by definition, deals with the physical world.
Whose definition?
That's what science does.
It deals with the physical world.
Okay. Makes observations of the physical world, and makes measurements, things
right.
like that. It doesn't comment on morality. So if you want to, it doesn't offer an explanation of that. I guess, and to me, and on the Bible tells us that there is a physical world and there's a spiritual world. So my question then is, what evidence can we point to that demonstrates that supernatural exists? The fellow you were talking to said he didn't believe in the supernatural. So if the supernatural does exist, one thing that tells us is that there's a physical world and a supernatural world. There's two things. So, and if there's a supernatural world and we can demonstrate that it's there, it's more than science can explain. So that seems to be a critical question to me, anyway, of what can we point to other than our belief, our belief in what the New Testament tells us and things like this. What can we point to demonstrate non-believers that of a spiritual world?
Can you, Norm, can you see, like, inside my computer? Because that's, like, our next slide. That's pretty good.
Can I see your computer?
That's awesome.
No.
Well, you want to go there?
I do, but I'd like to make a couple of points first. One is, generally speaking, the definition of science accords completely the way you described it. And that is, it's an enterprise that's intended to explain or characterize or make predictions on the basis of observations of phenomena and explain them only in terms of physical causes. Now, one of the interesting things is you mentioned it doesn't talk about morality and the whys of things.
And purpose and
yeah, but yeah. But here's an interesting problem. If you go into the realm of evolutionary psychology, which purports to be a science and which is by some people regarded as a science, although there are different strains of that, there are people who are scientists and psychologists who will say that there are actually physical explanations for morality, for beliefs, for behaviors that we account for theologically. That does not change the definition of science. But what it does do is it lets us see that there are ways that science is trying to, at least some branches of science, most don't care. Most are just focused on whatever experiments they want to work on their theory. But evolutionary psychology most certainly does look at things like morality, ethics, beauty, the very things that we believe are supernaturally created and supernaturally endowed. So I wanted to make sure we got that point across, because that's really important. It's okay. Not entirely physical causes create physical effects. For all things, there are some what we would call psychic things, things in our psyches that you can't see, but you can see the effects of, that are claimed to be have physical causes.
Right. Any other questions before we go?
Could I respond?
Yeah.
That first in science, I mean, science depends on data, physical data, and these experiments. These experiments that you described of were psychological, whatever, I forget the other words you said. Do they have physical data to support those assertions? If they don't, I mean, now we're really questioning what is science and if that is basically a scientific statement.
Yeah, I would say that they're making bald assertions.
Yeah.
That they don't have evidence, but here's the kind of evidence that they would appeal to. Their appeal would be this: for example, in one case in evolutionary psychology, they'd say the reason that humans today have a fear response is that before our history, if you didn't have a fear response, you'd get eaten up by the creatures who were alive at the time. So that we evolved this fear response in order to survive. That's their claim would be the evolutionary paradigm accommodates this, and all we have to do is look at the lineages and how things work, and you can see natural selection, and I know I'm getting kind of attenuated here, but that is the kind of evidence that they use and the kind of observations that they make. Our current things that we do, and what would be, and then they go backwards in time and say, okay, if evolution is true, or given that evolution is true, these are the kinds of explanations that would tell us why we feel the way we feel today, or do what we do.
Okay, but that explanation depends upon a person's interpretation of not physical data, and I mean, so. To me, anyway, that's what they're not depending upon physical data in that case. So that, to me, that's a real question of whether it's science or not.
Okay, I won't dispute that.
Norm, I'm going to use this as a teaser. The next slide, the first item, if it is true, and I believe it is, and it has occurred one time in human history, it is a defeater of naturalism. There is no way to. I don't think naturalism can explain it, no matter how much they modify their theory. And we're going to get to it in a moment. How's that? You guys all awake now? Okay.
The word I want to explore is the word consciousness. And I remember seeing a video by a physicist, a quantum physicist, that says when they did certain experiments, when they observed the experiment, it changed. And so they don't know why it changes, or there's other experiments where, and I don't know what part of the atom they were looking at, but they said you could take one part of the atom and have it here in Los Angeles spinning one way, and it could be in New York, and it will reverse the spin exactly at the same time.
Called so, quantum entanglement.
Yeah, that's it. So what is the consciousness that they're talking about?
You probably know better than I on that.
I don't know, and I know that there are different interpretations of what that means, you know, whether the person who's observing it or any observer, including a camera or something like that that's looking at the secondary effects of those events, has any effect on the actual interaction. All I can say is they can make predictions on it, but nobody can say for certain that an observer is what causes it.
I know that the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics is the interpretation that includes the idea that if there is an observer present, it changes the outcome of the experiment. But that is only one interpretation of the data from quantum mechanics, which is really bizarre. Okay.
I don't believe that atheism reject a supernatural. Driving to Bakersfield, looking at the trees and line, will give you saying that there's somebody put it in design. And what about the cell of human being, a simple cell that, so there is a lot of intelligence in that. The problem with that with them is that the answer we're giving them, which is God, our God, to them doesn't make sense, because to them is our God is cannot do it right. He created the angels, they split on him. I mean, they went, one-third of them went against him. Human beings, you come here to 100 years, and you're going to condemn for life, for eternity. It doesn't make sense to them. How can we respond to that answer?
Yeah, the question basically, as I understand it, has to do with how can we believe in a God who created a universe, a world that's just so messy and full of contradictory stuff. Does that kind of sum up?
Yeah.
Right. You want to try that, Mark? I've got some opinions on that.
Well, anytime you get into that kind of a debate, you open it up to the very thing that we brought to the table today, which is let's look at all of the evidence and which explanation is the best one. Theism, atheism, skepticism, whatever kind of ism you want to put,
right,
given the evidence. So if they say, well, you know, I don't buy your God because he screws things up, you know, he's got all these bad problems, you know, there's evil in the world, da 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 da. So okay, let's just look at that and compare. How do you have evil in the world if there's no God? Things like that. So you have all these different arguments that you have to put down, and certainly there are some good ones on all the sides. But the prevailing one, at least I believe, is the theistic, or the biblical God, has the, if you look at the entire scope of all the evidence that there is, the biblical God is the best evidence for existence of God,
yeah,
and for an explanation for why science does what it does. It explains phenomena, too.
Yeah, good. I think the way I would answer that, I would say, think about the issue that God must have had in his brain before he created anything. What would a creation that was worth creating, that would do anything, that would prove anything, that would have any lasting effect, what would it have to look like? And I think he's got a whole lot of options on everything, but it had to include some kind of free will. My wife and I last night started watching a movie called Artificial Intelligence, Spielberg film. I don't know how many of you guys have seen it, but it's really good. It explores a lot of very interesting questions about this. And one of the features of the film is that this couple that thinks their child died and they can't have a kid, they're just starting to invent robots that look like kids, and they're guaranteed to love you. Right? They can't.
I don't care if they love me. Do they obey me? That's what I. Yeah.
Yeah. And do they feed the dog? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. But it very slowly makes a really good case that if there is a being that can't help but love you, it's not really love. And so God could have created a universe that had no evil, no suffering, no pain, no sin, but wouldn't that have been like God just writing a script for a movie because he was bored and enacting the movie? There has to be some sense in there that I can't say that he didn't know how it was going to play out, but it had to play out on its own terms. And if something plays out on its own terms, it's going to look like the world that we have. It's going to be a mess. But in the end, he redeems it, and it all turns out the way he wants it to turn out. So that's my answer.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting about that is that there are Christian scholars, very brilliant folks, who will come up with explanations for why God did it the way he did it. Now, we know there's two aspects to that. One is, why did he do it as a function of ultimate purpose? So what's the telic end, the purpose, the grand idea behind it all? And the grand idea is ultimately to redeem us. But then why did he do it just this way and not some other way? Mm-hmm. Which is the point that the atheists will bring up. Well, if God's such a great guy, how come he allows tornadoes to kill people? Why does little babies die from these horribly painful diseases? Why does anybody die from these painful diseases?
Right. Why do we die at all?
Why are people killing each other? And all, you know, there's just all sorts of things they can say. And they say, well, God could have made it a different way. And what we need to realize is we don't know why God did it exactly the way he did it. He just did it. And when people say, well, you know, like Neil deGrasse Tyson says, well, you know, the human body's a mess, and he comes up with some pretty insulting ways of describing that. Say, all right, look, if you're God and you come up with this way and the people that you created can't figure it out, you, Mr. deGrasse Tyson, explain to me how you're going to do it better.
Right.
Now, he can say, well, I'll do this and that. And the other thing is, well, you've got a whole ecology you've got to deal with, not just one body. So we have to be careful that we don't try to argue a particular way and a particular, the reason it happened just exactly this way is because this is why. We don't know. And we need to be real careful so that we're not arguing against, you know, well, this was optimized for this and this is optimized for that. We can give some explanations, but we don't really know. We don't really know. All we know is things work the way they work, and let's find out more about God by looking at them.
What that really is an argument that I don't believe in God because I could have done it better.
In some respects, that's exactly what they're coming up with.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good job. I like to look into their life a little bit and say, how good a life did you make for yourself? You know, not did you become a millionaire, but your relations with people and so forth. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get to... Oh, go ahead. Microphone. I want to get to my naturalism killer.
Ray Bradbury wrote a short story called A Sound of Thunder, mm-hmm. And it was about going back into the future, into the dinosaur age, and to make a long story short, a man stepped on a butterfly, and it changed all the events of history. So it's like almost every event that's ever happened had to happen for us to be here in the way we're here today.
So, seems so random.
Yeah, so that kind of gives an idea that God is in control of everything.
It's called the butterfly effect, that some really small event in history can have a giant effect on.
A sovereign God who has more intelligence than any of us could even conceive of is going to do things in a way that we would never conceive of. I look at the strange things in the universe and the strange things in life and even strange things in theology, a trinity, a triune God who describes himself as three persons and one person at the same time, as the kinds of things that I would expect from a God. I would expect things that would go beyond my understanding and beyond anyone's understanding from a God who is the God of the Bible.
Even the understanding of the brilliant Mark Perez.
Oh, that's one of, that would be the first thing.
Ellen.
Going back to the question, what evidence do we have that Jesus was real and the Bible is true? I like to refer to the historical evidence, because all history was divided into before Christ and AD afterwards, and it's a historical fact that Jesus lived and that he was resurrected. Everybody doesn't believe that, but there were over 500 people that saw him after he was crucified, and that's the evidence we have in the Bible. But I think it's good to recognize how history recognizes this, and I'm thankful for all the scientific information that I receive in this class, but I also appreciate the fact that history recognizes that too.
Yeah, that's really good, and if we get to it, it's on my list. You're looking inside my computer too. So
there's a hole in it right up there. They're looking through that hole.
I bet there's a screen on the back that
yeah.
shows the next slide. Okay, all right, so all of atheism relies on this idea of naturalism, this idea that there is nothing real outside of the physical universe. It's, what's his name's great statement, the universe is all there was, all there
Carl
is,
Sagan.
And all there ever yeah. will be. Okay, that pretty much sums it up. There is nothing to be learned from anything outside of that, because there is nothing outside of that. Although that's actually a self-defeating statement yeah. because it's a statement from philosophy, not science does not prove that statement.
You can't.
Right.
Yeah.
So if anybody gives you that, you say, why do you believe that statement if science is all there is? So this is the best time to be alive to argue against naturalism, the best time in the scientific era, I think. And I put this list together that's actually two pages on here, and the last one is evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. We probably won't get to it because we've got 25 minutes, but I want to spend some time on the first one. I think it's amazing because everybody can use it as an argument. So I'm calling this a defective computer is what it is. Okay, naturalism ninjas, ways to kill naturalism with the sword quickly and efficiently. So this is one of my favorite ones, is near-death experiences. And I did a talk on this in Paradoxes years ago, but I want to talk about it really quickly. There's two kinds of near-death experiences. There's the ones that where people see a light, or they hear voices, or they see Jesus before they die, or they're on the operating table and they go into a coma or something. Those can potentially be explainable by just brain states when you're dying, or hallucinogenic effects, hallucinations, thank you. But there is another type of near-death experience that I think kills naturalism with the sword and cuts its head off and kicks it in the hole and buries it and burns it. And that is, there are near-death experiences where people have experiences that correspond to reality. In other words, there's this really classic one where this woman was on the operating table and she was dying, and she left her body, and her body went up to the roof of the hospital where she was dying, and on the roof of the hospital, somebody had thrown a red tennis shoe. And she came, for whatever reason, back into her body. They started to revive her, so she came back in, and she recounted to the nurse the description of the red tennis shoe on the roof, and they went up and looked on the roof, and there was the red tennis shoe, just as she described it. Now, think about what that means. And there's hundreds of these now in the literature. There's actually a peer-reviewed journal for near-death experiences. Think about what that means. Her body was on the operating table in a coma. Her eyes were closed. She went up to the roof and had an experience that was a true experience because it corresponded with the real world. So I would like to say to a naturalist, when the photons came off the sun and reflected off the tennis shoe and she perceived it, what was the perceptive apparatus that perceived that photon if her body is dozens of feet away on the operating table? And here's the most amazing thing, even more amazing than that in the way that I think about it, is not only did she experience it, but she remembered it. So where was that memory stored before she got back to her body? Now, I can't think of any naturalistic explanation, no matter how advanced science ever gets, that will be able to explain that from a naturalistic standpoint. And again, all it takes is one of those ever in human history, and naturalism is done. But it happens. It's happened hundreds and hundreds of times in the recorded literature. What do you want to say about that?
Well, I don't know that naturalism would be done because that doesn't show that God exists. It merely shows that there's an alternate state of psychic presence. So if I were a naturalist, and I would say, all right, let's say that we've interviewed everybody and we've got many cases like this, and there are, it's indisputable that the facts are indisputable. Mm-hmm. This person saw something they could never have access to. Let's say they went between the rafters of a house or something that nobody's ever been to since it was built.
Right.
And she says, well, there's a 2x4 that's shaped like a star, and I saw it. And they go up there and they find it. Okay, so there's no disputing the facts. Let's just say that. Take that as a given. If I'm a naturalist, I'm saying, I don't know how that happened. But you don't need God to make that to happen. That could happen. So there's some other kind of way that our minds can project through space. We don't know what it is yet. But it's obvious because she was still alive. So whatever is experienced, maybe it's more than just our 5 or maybe 6 perceptions or senses that we want to describe all. Maybe there's a 7th. Maybe there's an 8th or a 9th. There is some evidence right now that's just coming out that we may be able to experience the magnetism of the Earth, that humans may be able to. Mm-hmm. That's never before even countenanced. So if I'm a naturalist, I'm thinking, all right, I don't understand how this would work, but that doesn't mean it requires a God.
Okay, so this is some of the most fun you and I have, where one of us takes one position and one takes the other. So, Mr. Naturalism, I'm gonna beat you up here. Okay, so if you're a naturalist, you believe that the human body is reducible to purely scientific and effects, that there is no separate thing. The mind is not separate from the brain, that it is only emerges from their brain, but it can all be explained by physical processes.
It will start, yes. It is a reductionist program.
Okay.
It all reduces to the physical world.
Okay, so the only way that the human mind can perceive something is through the senses that we have. We know about sight, hearing, smell, taste, and touch. And there may be some magnetically sensitive thing that we don't know about yet that detects.
Sure.
That, but that could be explainable scientifically.
Physically, yeah.
Right. Okay. So there is no way for the human body to perceive, to sense something that is outside of the range of its sensory apparatus then, correct?
Yes. Yes. All right. I'll let you go with that.
Okay. So you can't see through this wall.
Correct.
Okay. So when the lady perceived the red tennis shoe on the roof, where were the photon? What apparatus were? What physical materialistic apparatus was the, were the photons touching that she was able to perceive it?
If I were a naturalist, I would argue that we have some kind of sensory apparatus that we don't know about yet that would explain that, and that I don't need God to explain it. I can just keep on working on some kind of apparatus, some kind of perception that we have that transcends things like wood or whatever we can't see with our eyes and sense with our hearing and smell and so forth. So if I grant your physical phenomena, then you're going to have to grant that it's possible that there's a naturalistic way of explaining it that we just don't know about yet. But why do I have to employ God when we haven't done enough experimentation with the reductionist program?
Well, first of all, I'm not arguing for God here on this point. I'm just arguing that naturalism is incomplete.
Okay, it's naturalism is incomplete to this point, and that is that you have now opened up a new domain of research, mm-hmm. which is the near-death experience that allows people to see things or experience things, and we call it seeing, but whatever it is, that we didn't know happened before. So now, as a phenomenalist or a scientist, I'm going to say, so now we're finding there must be another sense, and we need to explore that other sense. And let's just not even talk about God. Let's say, I have no idea what kind of experiments we're going to do because I can't put people into this near-death experience and hope they come back.
I know some people I'd like.
Well, maybe, but there would be an ethical problem with that. Yeah. So that's what I would, that's to put it shortly, that's what I would say if I were a naturalist. Now, I don't buy that, but I can see a naturalist explanation going along those lines, and it would not be irrational.
But I think they're just changing the definition of naturalism to include something that can't be explained in the understanding that we have now of naturalism. And if they want to include the supernatural in the natural, I'm good with that because it's all God's creation and follows his rules.
Well, no, the argument isn't that it's supernatural. The scientist who agrees, who takes your evidence and says, I buy it,
uh-huh.
is saying, we just don't know how this works. And we do, because it's such a new phenomenon to describe, we're just beginning on this project. You know, we've been looking at sight and hearing and all these other things for centuries, and now we're just coming up to this, and you expect us to give you a completely perfect explanation for it? I don't think so. That's not even fair. And so if that's my naturalistic way of approaching that.
Well, I'm just going to leave with this argument because I'm right, and I want to.
You probably are right, but that's.
I would say to a naturalist, I know there's a question back there. I'll get you in a second.
There's one over there, too.
Oh, there is.
And he's important. He hasn't asked one yet.
I would say, from a naturalistic explanation, the only way that we can perceive photons is with our eyeballs. And if this person's eyeballs are on the operating table and they're still perceiving photons corresponding to reality up there on the roof of the hospital, that is not within the range of a normal explanation of naturalism.
You're presuming two things. Number one, that only photons could give you an image of that object, mm-hmm. whatever the object is. And number two, that we have to rely on the known perceptions that we have to explain it.
Fair enough. Okay. Back there. You want to take... Okay, Phil?
Actually, we have a question from Doug, which is actually not this question, and then I've got a question myself. But Doug's question, I'll just get it out here, and whenever you want to answer it, you can answer it. He says, this is Doug from class, what are the weaknesses of the Kalam cosmological argument?
Kalam.
Kalam? Kalam, okay. that it does that it doesn't specify what the cause is. Is it what caused God? And how do you explain to people that it is not the special pleading fallacy saying that God has no cause? That's his question. Now, my question, or my comment here, haven't the Russians spent a lot of time studying this very thing, the metaphysical aspects of this? And I haven't seen any published stuff myself, but I believe folks are looking into this in some serious fashion. I don't know if anybody has any question, any comment about that. What you guys are talking about right now, the sixth sense.
I know
the metaphysical aspects of it.
I know the Russians spent a lot of time studying psychic phenomena, like can you move stuff, psychically, and it went nowhere. I don't know if they ever studied. I don't know if they studied this.
Well, it wasn't just the Russians. There were a lot of people who've been studying this ESP, mm-hmm. The extrasensory perception. It goes back decades. And in terms of the question about near-death experience, being able to detach and see some other things, that was discussed decades ago, mm-hmm. but it hasn't been anywhere nearly well documented as it is today. So the answer to that question is, yes, the Russians have, but so a whole bunch of other people, including the American military.
Right.
Yeah. And so we don't need to go too deep into that as to who's been doing it. It's a fascinating thing. There's nobody who doesn't care about it. Everybody thinks it's interesting. And it is interesting. And if it has a natural explanation, we sure want to know it. If it doesn't, we want to know that too.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of the cosmological argument, the Kalam cosmological argument, I don't want to talk about that without it sitting in front of me because it has a lot of premises to it. And so the argument basically is there's no way to get causes without a cause, or no way to get effects without a cause, but God would be the uncaused cause. The uncaused cause, and therefore he exists. That's incredibly simplified. So I don't want to get into the details of that because it takes a lot of time to go through step by step each one of those premises in the argument, and it's a lot more complicated than it looks.
Dan.
Okay, you said that you were right, but I think you're wrong, in my opinion. And
What question are you saying that he's wrong about?
He claims that this experience is real. And he mentioned the protons and whatever, that is real.
Now, you're talking about near-death experience?
Yes.
Okay.
So that means you're assuming that that's true. And my friend there next to you kind of goes along to say, well, yeah, it could have been this and that. But there's an explanation for this. Very simple. When you have a dream, you don't see too many details. You don't see, if you have a dream of people like this, you don't see a blonde over there, you see
right.
a guy with no details, you don't assume that that's true. Now, there's another dimension. Dr. Ross believes, and I agree with him, that some of these phenomena, even including the UFOs, are demonic stuff. The God of this world, the chairman of the board, can do anything to the point that they can fool you. Just because this person says he went to heaven and come back, it's not true. And not only that, some of these experiences contradict the Bible. So if it does contradict the Bible, that's not a real experience, physical. So it could be a demonic giving you that impression that in your mind, like when you have a dream in your mind, you think that's real and maybe give you details. Well, how can he know that there was the guy operating in the tomb was a blonde, he had blue eyes or whatever. The devil can do that. And that's my explanation.
Well, that's fine, Dan. I'm trying to make the distinction between two kinds of near-death experiences. One, which
is leaves the body.
Like a dream. One is like a dream or a vision, which could be explained. It could be real, and it could be explainable by something going on. A naturalist is not going to be affected by influenced by that kind of explanation. Oh, I saw God. Okay. I'm talking about the ones where people have they see something that corresponds to reality. In other words, you don't have a dream that is perfectly accurate with reality in every detail. You perceive that. There's several of them where people saw, were actually able to read the measurements on the equipment that was being used while they were being operated on.
Well, the devil can do that.
Well, that's true. But what I'm saying is, Dan, that my point is that this is an explanation, this is an argument against naturalism. And whether you explain it that it actually happened or the devil made me do it, either one of those is an argument against
but
naturalism.
Just because she says so, that's mean true. You assume that it's true.
Well, Dan, if it corresponds with what actually happened,
well, sure.
Then it is it's true. You can't just say it didn't happen.
No. You assume you cannot tell for sure that it's true.
Yes, you can. You went up on the roof, and the red tennis shoe was actually up there.
Oh, that's what she said.
Right, she said it, and it was true.
Oh, true. No.
Dan, there's a lot of these that have been documented by physicians and nurses who aren't believers were willing to say, yes, this happened like this. The patient saw things that they would not have been able to see, even if they were awake and conscious on the operating table. So,
One of the problems with these, I mean, in science, you have to be able to repeat something. And so that this incident that you talked about, I'm not saying it isn't true, but the fact that if it is true, I mean, it seems to be good evidence for spirituality. So that's what we're up against, is that it's without some repeatability, it's hard to it's hard to document as scientific evidence anyway. Well, I'd like to mention one other thing also, going back some, and that was the comment made earlier about the suffering that goes on in the world and how that's unexplainable, and that's true. But if you look at all of the questions that you have to address in explaining the universe, man, complexity of species, everything else, the one question that we can't answer as Christians probably is we don't understand why the suffering is there, other than you offered one possible explanation, I think, Ross. But on the other hand, on the other side of the question, those who deny God can't answer any question except bring up that one doubt about why suffering is here. Every other question is answered in the Bible. And anyway, that's my response to that.
Okay. Mark, we've got like 4 minutes left. Do you want to try to take one more of these on, or what do you want to do? Talk about molecular biology and for a minute, for three.
Okay, yeah, all right. In 4 minutes, we're going to talk about molecular biology. What in particular are you thinking about molecular biology in terms of the origin of life?
Yes. I turned Mark onto a video on YouTube. If you guys are interested, look up a guy named James Tour, T-O-U-R. He's a molecular biologist and a Christian and has some really interesting comments on origin of life and origin of life research.
Yeah, James Tour is one of the most brilliant people I've ever seen. I think he's on par with Hugh Ross in terms of his ability to describe the problems of the origin of life coming purely biochemically. And he does it in such a short span. I mean, 45 minutes, he just knocks it out of the park. But I think the real question about molecular biology and the origin of life is, what evidence do we have? And can the evolution theorist give us something other than wishful thinking to believe that there will ever be a scientific explanation for the origin of life? And the answer right now is, the only way that the naturalist can look at the origin of life and say, yes, we will come up to a solution to it, is to have some evidence for it. And right now they have none, zero. There's no evidence that shows a pathway from non-living things to the first living thing. None at all. Furthermore, the naturalist also has to give us an explanation for why they believe that they could find it. Is it even discoverable? And the answer to that right now appears to be no. Appears to be. So if I'm going to answer the naturalist who says, well, you believe the original life came from God, and we believe the original life came from nature, from physics, we hold the upper hand because we have evidence outside of the scientific world for the existence of God and for his operation, and to believe that he would have done something like this, whereas the naturalists have nothing. And I would ask the naturalist, please give me an explanation for how you can prove to me that you can even come up with a solution to this. They won't. They can't. And if you look in the literature, it repeats over and over. It says, this may be the intractable question of science. So molecular biology, from an origin of life viewpoint, is going to be, right now, it is a disaster to naturalism.
He makes the astounding claim in that video that in 60 years of origin of life being a scientific discipline, there has been zero progress.
Because every time they come up with one solution to a speculation, there's another solution that shows that that's false.
Yeah. He uses this pretty good analogy. He says, it's like, you know, they may come up with one little idea of how this first process could start. And it's like saying, we know how to build a cathedral because we know how to make one brick. It's kind of on that level of complexity.
Yeah, the last thing I would say is that if you have a particular scientific theory and every time you test it, it continues to fail, and every time you test it from different perspectives, whether it's geology or astrophysics or any of these different scientific disciplines, and you keep pressing it against them, and they keep failing over and over and over from every single attempt. These are called anomalies. And when you build up that many anomalies, at a certain point, you end up in a crisis. You just can't go any further. The paradigm does not supply sufficient evidence to even give you the possibility of an answer. And I think that's where the origin of life is now, and I don't think they can escape that.
Mark, it's 17 after. We're going to take one question from John because he's had his hand up for like 45 minutes, and then we got to end this. John.
Okay, one trivial item. The account I read of the tennis shoe in the hospital was that it was fairly well documented, by the way. There's a lot of witnesses that backed everything up, but they looked and looked on the roof for a week, and they didn't find any tennis shoe. And then a week later, a window washer noticed it. It was on a ledge that nobody could see from the ground or any of the windows. You had to be outside the building, and that's when they finally discovered it. But also to open up an atheist to the possibility of something beyond material, to recognize or to bring up the fact that most cosmologists state that they conclude that whatever it was that caused the inception of space-time of the universe, it was something which transcends space-time. So that's almost like a something given. Also, to go into the error of John Mill in the 19th century and later Aldous Huxley, who wrote a book called Why I'm Not a Christian, they went on the premise that everything has a cause. And that was not true. Only every effect has a cause. And Albert Einstein wondered, why anything exists at all. It seemed more reasonable that nothing at all would exist. And to think about it and really examine that carefully, you realize that in order for anything to exist at all, there must be something which is self-existent. And that's a very difficult concept to grasp. But the nature of this of what is self-existent. You know, some people will say, "Oh, quantum fields are self-existent." Well, that's that's a little hard to. that's pure speculation. But anyway, to realize there must be something which is self-existent, and then to examine the evidence that some of the things you pointed out before that are evident of the consequences of what that entity was, that entity that is self-existent. In other words, the design, the fine-tuning, all these things that derive indicate intention, will, and intelligence, and things like that. In fact, the biologists are saying that there must have been some intervention of an intelligent agent. And
thank you, John. We have to cut it there.
Yeah, we've got to go.
Yeah, thank you very much for that, though.
Everybody, thank you. I hope you've enjoyed it. Mark,
good job.
Thanks, everybody. We'll maybe someday we'll finish this.